and welcome to Label Sessions Presents, the podcast where we talk to the most interesting people about all the things you need to know in the world of innovation, business, design, tech, and culture. I'm Fazlin Esau, all the way from Cape Town, South Africa. Today, we're welcoming three brand new label mates from all over the world to our growing list of experts. We're also joined by Label Sessions founder, Nick Sherrod. Nick, what are we diving into this week?
So this week, we want to talk about... well, the rumors, at least, that the original founders of Ben & Jerry's are buying back the brand. And that sparks a conversation that we've had a few times with marketing directors recently around, if you, you know, when you're running a brand, when is the right time to go back to your roots? And when is the right time to self-consciously do something new? Also, want to talk around an interesting survey which suggested that a third of Brits were ready to plan their holiday with AI. We want to talk around, would you plan a holiday with AI? And in particular, what does AI offer travel? And what does, you know, how should we think through AI for a host of new industries? And then finally, also, I want to jump over to F1. So a sport that is growing its audience in a whole host of ways, and in particular, growing a female audience. And with that, we had a brand we know and love lots of Label Sessions. We work with lots of Lululemon who have made Lewis Hamilton one of their ambassadors. I want to talk through... when is it, you know, when can it be that a sponsor can actually be driving innovation rather than just backing it?
Amazing. Thanks, Nick. Also, welcome back to Josh Nixon, our content king. Josh, what can we expect content-wise from Label Sessions this week?
That never gets old, that. We can expect a few things. So we've got, we're continuing a lovely run of Lumen Accelerators. So we've got a few coming up in the next few weeks, focusing on procurement innovation, artificial intelligence and personalities, and futures and innovation for a few of our Lumenites who are still too soon to announce, but they're coming through the pipeline, in addition to the accelerators that we've already got out with Ravi Bala in consumer duty, Jez Goldstone in cybersecurity or cyber innovation, sorry, and a lovely piano maestro Vincent Corver with his Sonic brand accelerator.
Thanks, Josh. Let's jump right in and welcome our new label mate. A big welcome to Phoebe Liu. Phoebe is a global strategist specializing in consumer insights-driven innovation across FMCG, consumer technology, and hospitality industries, and has worked for the likes of Johnson & Johnson, Ford, Lincoln, and Unilever. Phoebe's also joining us all the way from China today. Phoebe, what excites you right now about the world of innovation?
I think because right now I'm in China, I think almost the buzzword in China is AI, because especially the launch of DeepSeek early January this year. So it's like it's everywhere on media and not. On media, I think firstly, not only like all of the big platforms are trying to integrate the DeepSeek into the system, and also government organization is also making the very, very big advancements in embedding DeepSeek into their system. So the AI is like changing our life, our work in almost every aspect. You don't know where this is going, but it's definitely going to change our life. I think that's the most exciting things happening right now. So how that is going to influence not only our life, our work, but perhaps even in the future, how our human beings, our physical body is going to coexist with AI. I think that's the question everyone is asking ourselves. Yeah, that's my
present
from China.
100%. Also, a big welcome to Richard Denton. Richard is known for campaigns that deliver both commercial success and lasting impact. His expertise spans sponsorship activation, brand development, and education. And he has collaborated with international sports federations at global brands such as Rugby World Cup, Yamaha Motors, and Philips to turn bold ideas into enduring legacies. Richard, what can we learn from brands who are doing it right at this moment?
Well, brands who are doing it right at this moment will be not only acquiring customers, but they'll be holding on to those customers, which is probably one of the biggest challenges we all face today. Leading on a little bit from what Phoebe said, of course, the technology has become so powerful that we can communicate with so many people through so many different channels nowadays. How you make sure that once you've hooked that potential customer, that you can create the long-term relationship that we're all looking for, whether you're a retail brand or whether you're more business to business, or even if in the nonprofit arena, you know, there's a lot of competition out there for people's minds and wallets. So I think I'm always looking to try and find those brands who have some sort of a secret sauce, or they're doing something maybe which other brands are maybe not quite doing in the same way, and try to learn from that, you know, and see whether it's applicable to startups or whether it's applicable to social causes, or, you know, just simple things in the daily life that we see every day. So I'm always looking out for these brands that are doing it right. You touched on artificial integration, but I think the first story about Ben and Jerry's was an interesting topic as well, because that's all about social purpose and ethical leadership as well. And then put that into the mix with artificial integration, and I think you've got a fascinating topic for discussion. So plenty of to chew on there, I think.
Amazing. Thanks, Richard. We're also joined by Rich Brown. Rich is a cybersecurity strategist and compliance expert with a unique journey from law enforcement to cybersecurity leadership. He's most known for bridging the gap between regulations, compliance, and practical cyber defense. Rich, what should leaders be thinking about right now when it comes to cybersecurity?
It's not a one-time thing. It's a constant and ever-evolving playing field. There are always threats, vulnerabilities. With updates come more vulnerabilities. Everybody saw with the CrowdStrike outage and all the airlines and all that. That was through an update. So it's not always a threat, but it's also just errors, gaps in knowledge, insider threats, which can be not deliberate. It can be just simple mistakes. It can also be new regulations based on industry. For example, healthcare has regulations. Contractors have regulations, Department of Defense or energy. So with those changes, having that knowledge to be able to share with those leaders is where I come in. Hopefully to alleviate some of the stress and some of the technical jargon to help translate that into something more digestible.
Okay, so it has, as per usual, been a very busy week in tech design, culture, and innovation. And one of the stories that Nick mentioned earlier is the founders of Ben & Jerry's are trying to perhaps get their brand back from Unilever and take it back to its roots. If you're a leading brand, when is the right time to go back to your roots, to go back to those initial values? And when is the right time to leave some of that behind and become something new? Let's maybe Phoebe.
Yeah, I think if I was a brand owner, I think it's really up to my my value. So then my personal value, whether it's in line or like clash with the corporate world. I know, for example, in the case of Ben & Jerry's and Unilever, I was quite familiar with Unilever. Unilever have been like promoting this like sustainability or this kind of like a concept for years. But I also knew that from financial perspective, the corporate world actually is under stress of whether this concept actually can make a profitable business for them. So I think for the corporate world, they definitely have this like pressure from the business, from financial perspective. But for a brand owner, we create a brand out of our own love or out of our own personal values. We want to create a brand which people love, which can fit our own social value systems. So I think it's that like a relationship between our own value and also corporate world. Corporate world's their intention with the brand is actually, I think it's constantly changing. And their business change as the overall social dynamic change, the relationship might be the way they take the brand, the way they market the brand, or even the product that developed out of that brand probably is also under ongoing change. So I think whether the brand owner should or not take back the brand to come to its own roots, it should be under like an ongoing review, an ongoing discussion with the brand guardian. And also, I think from the very beginning, the brand owners and also the brand guardian should have like a, sort of like aligned measures. So with are there like certain dimensions, certain criteria shouldn't go far away. Of course, the visual leave a space for them to be innovate because the world is changing, culture is changing, people are changing, technology all changing. We should allow the freedom for them to try a bit to go beyond like the past history to do something new. But they shouldn't cross a certain line. I think the line is the fine line. Both sides should be very careful, and it should be on the ongoing like discussions. Unless till someday the two sides cannot agree on each other, things that go too far and cannot like meet our initial purpose, I think that's a point the brand owner should consider take back the brand. That's my viewpoint.
Richard, you had something interesting to say as well around this just a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of working with Unilever for a number of years based out of the Benelux here. I think they introduced me to something, three letters called IFO, which stood for Income for Operations. And every time that dropped below 6%, essentially it meant there was a round of cost cutting. And when you're a marketeer, of course, the last word you want here is cost cutting, because marketing budgets are generally the easiest ones to cut. But having said that, I must say that Unilever did invest quite a significant amount of money into the sport and entertainment space. And this was around the period of like 2010, 2011, 2012. And I think that's when the former executive, Paul Pullman, introduced this whole idea of sustainability and said, we need to develop sustainable brands. And everybody said, well, actually, we need profitable brands to be sustainable. And he said, no, we're going to develop sustainable brands in order to be profitable. And of course, the market at the time was a little bit skeptical, but the research since then has proven that if you develop sustainable brands, generally speaking, in a circular economy, yeah, then you can also have a higher profitability as well. So it's interesting, this story about Ben and Jerry's, because this goes back to 2000, which at the time I think raised a few eyebrows, and they were paid handsomely for their company at the time. And it happens quite often like that, doesn't it? You know, a buyout, you stay around for 5 years, then you leave the organization, it dips down, and then the original owners come back in again and try to revive it. And I think it comes back to some of the points that have been raised is, you know, what was the original belief? You know, what were the original values? What was the original philosophy? And perhaps for a few people, maybe when Ben & Jerry's became part of Unilever, it lost that little bit of magic, you know, that it was now part of a corporate giant, didn't have its independence. And it's funny how things like that happen, because there's a similarity here with another story in MySpace, which is Nike, who recently also got rid of their CEO, Donahue, and brought back a 32-year-old veteran, or 32 years working at Nike before he left, Elliott Hill, and brought him back in to revive the brand. So it's strange how people who create brands, who build brands, seem to have some sort of affinity with that brand. And when you remove them, or when you don't give them the freedom that they want in order to continue to build the brand, it maybe loses its shine or its sparkle somehow. And so I think it's not an uncommon trend. Whether it will happen or not with Ben & Jerry's, time will tell. But yeah, I think it's definitely, it's a cyclical thing. You know, we see this again more often where people return back to an original brand in order to revive it, or they take a management buyout and they regain control, and they blow some new life into that brand. And yeah, I guess, you know, perhaps that's not such a bad thing after all, if we can keep these lovely brands like Ben & Jerry's alive.
It's an interesting case with Ben & Jerry's in particular as well, because they've been owned by Unilever for about as long as I've been alive.
Yeah.
So it makes me wonder how much of it is going to be perceivable to the average consumer about whether or not it is going to go back to its roots, because its roots to me have always been, you know, it's always been seen as an economically conscious brand. And if that's the big concern of them coming back to take it off of Unilever's hands, is the average person even going to particularly notice, is what I was thinking.
There's an interesting thing as well, I think, within this, which is I'm conscious. So before, a label session used to be a more conventional consultant, so going into big companies to do transformations and things. And I'm always aware that one of the messages that you'd always get a warm response around was the idea of going back to your roots. People always like it in-house. But there are challenges that come with it, partly because the rest of the world has moved on. So it's interesting for Ben and Jerry's, I guess, because they were so unusual at the time to have this kind of story wrapped around their brand, which made it so engaging and socially conscious and all those kind of things. Now, even in the ice cream aisle, there's quite a few that are there. And actually, there's a few that do things that Ben and Jerry's never used to do, which like think about how healthy the product is and where the milk comes from and all these sort of things. So there is sometimes, I think, there's some great stories around sort of refreshing or revitalizing a brand through reconnecting to the roots. Nike would be the kind of poster child of that just now, I guess. But it's also a challenge sometimes, which is sometimes your roots, if you really brought them back to where they are right now, would actually themselves be an issue, or they wouldn't be following through. You know, sometimes, and I think therefore, sometimes people can underestimate the thing that in some ways, if you really want to reinvigorate Ben & Jerry's, you need to find something that's as radical as Ben & Jerry's was, rather than bringing the old Ben & Jerry's back.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. And I mean, you raised Ben & Jerry's, but I can remember an ice cream brand that was actually considered to be maybe even more cool than Ben & Jerry's a long time ago, which was Häagen-Dazs. You know, and when we all found out about that, we were like, wow, where did this come from? And, you know, it's got this sort of Scandinavian appeal and stuff. And so, yeah, you dig around and you try to find out. I think it boils down to a couple of things. Authenticity. It's an overused word nowadays, but authenticity is really important in brand building. You know, and of course, now we've got more complex dynamics to deal with, you know, diversity, inclusion, things like that as well. Like you said, the circular economy, you know, how much is the carbon footprint, for example, of flying different ingredients around the world simply in order to provide us with what is maybe a luxury pleasure in some cases, you know, do we really need all of these luxury brands of ice cream when there are perhaps more pressing challenges in the world? But of course, yeah, if we applied that to everything, you know, then we'd all be, you know, probably vanilla, to use an ice cream expression. And marketing terms, being vanilla is not a good place to be because it means you don't appeal to anybody generally. So yeah, there's some interesting times ahead. And I think you're right, is how can you make something which is 20, 30 years old, you know, relevant again today? And if you weren't around when the original brand was born, you know, I see a lot of kids wearing Air Jordans today. They've probably got no idea what Michael Jordan did back in the 1980s and the story behind Air Jordan and how that was created, but they're still willing to shell out, you know, $250 or whatever it is, you know, buying the latest Air Jordans, which is an amazing, you know, reflection on brand equity and brand strength and everything else that Nike's invested into this wonderful brand in recent years.
I also saw Rich from America there during, like, a bit of laughter about it. Some people don't know who Michael Jordan is, Rich. The rest of the world somehow sometimes doesn't know basic things, right?
I think we should hear from some American representation here because I'm sure that Mr. Jordan, United States.
He's like, oh, LeBron. I'm like, I'm not listening to any of that LeBron talk. They don't know. They just didn't witness it, so they can't speak on it.
The next thing that's been really big. So one third of Brits, and also this one South African over here, would plan a holiday with AI. The question is, would you plan a holiday with AI? And also, what are the security implications of planning a holiday, a time away through a platform that is so open? Rich, maybe you can weigh in on this in terms of AI and security and doing the simple things like planning a holiday.
So AI is my best friend, and it's such a powerful tool. And if you're descriptive and you know exactly what you're looking for, it's like taking a limitless pill. Like it's just, your ideas are just, so you can think about, okay, what do I want to eat for dinner tonight? What part of town do I want to be in? What's the atmosphere? What's the location? Is it safe in the area? And those types of things. Not overly detailed with like what you're, like where, you, like where you'll be, like what hotel you'll stay at, those types of things. But thinking about finding a location where you can, you know, where locals hang out, you know, where tourists hang out, and avoid the tourist locations because that's where the crime may be. And mapping out your entire trip sounds like a fantastic idea. You'll find places that Yelp or TripAdvisor might overlook. But I think it's a fantastic idea. I'm all for it. And it just depends on what you want to do. If you're alone, if you're with family. Yeah, it's just it's a powerful tool that we need to use, because if you don't use it, it'll just take off without us. And I'm trying to teach older folks now that it's a good tool to use. You just have to be descriptive. You just can't say, what is this? Question mark. So if you're as detailed as possible, use trusted models. I love Google Gemini, because if you're going to Google search anyway, I think their servers are pretty secure. And that is, yeah, that's my go-to. ChatGPT is fun, but I just trust Gemini just because of Google's reputation. But I planned out moves. I've planned out to replace medication with supplement based on symptoms, based on height and weight, based on productivity, day, evening, night. And I have a whole regimen of based on my height and weight, how much to take of what. And it's been fantastic. So I'm all for it, just as long as it's on a trusted platform.
It definitely sounds like a limitless pill to you, Rich, especially with a supplement. And also, what does AI offer to the future of travel? What should all sectors keep in mind as they explore AI and the AI future? Phoebe, you touched on it in your introduction a little bit. What does the future of AI?
Yeah, I think in terms of AI in future, I remember a case, actually a concept we did when I was working with Formo company. We worked with Lincoln. So because you may know that electric vehicle is very advanced in China. Smart cars concept is very, very like advanced in China as well. So we actually developed a lot of concepts integrating AI into the car. So basically some concept like you drive a car and you drive to somewhere perhaps you're not familiar, and you could just simply ask the car, what I'm gonna do here? And in a few seconds, the car can tell you, okay, this is a thing you can do. And okay, let me drive to the other place. And the car will work like your travel guide to start introduction about everything about the place you are here. So in the entire journey, it's like a travel planner. Like everything, and as long as you can give him or her detailed request yourself. And from our testing with consumers, people all love it. And from personally, I think I also love it. It's so convenient. It saves so much time for us. Now travel, because we have so many platforms, we are booking flights, booking hotels, and book and find information to find the advice or tips from other travelers about where to go and what to eat or where to leave. AI can just finish the entire time. All of this, maybe in a few seconds. I think it's very convenient. It saves a lot of time. And also, actually it's kind of very smart. In the past, we think AI just like recommend. In the past, no, not really like AI in today's world. In the past, probably just recommend a few popular routes, a few popular choices for you. But now today, I think the AI has become very smart. For example, the map in China we are using, the map not only recommend the normal routes most people drive, actually they also very intentionally recommend some new routes people explore. Maybe just a bunch of very risk drivers want to take a very different routes, very small routes, but they live there. And then the AI actually can recommend this kind of route to people who are willing to take the risk of the venture. And of course, and then as long as time goes, as more people try to take the routes, and then the routes actually become another normal route for the majority. So the AI actually over the years, I think, have been trained to becoming very smart. And I'll have to say sometimes it's smarter than us. So in terms of future AI, I think as I touched at the very beginning, I think it's gonna change every aspect of our life and our work. And also not only AI in terms of software, but also robots. For example, in China, they're also experimenting with AI robots on the street working at a police patrol. So like, there are many areas. It's like in the software world, in the network, and also in the physical world, they are working like perhaps right now they are learning from human beings, work at like an assistant for human beings, but they don't know in future perhaps they will replace some of us. And how we are going to co-work, co-live with them, I think that's the future we don't know yet. We are all like trying to figure out and to experience. And we'll perhaps some years later we'll know how we are coexisting with them.
It's interesting that
Chinese is in the future already.
Yeah. I've been saying that because I think there's an interesting thing where I've just noted recently in the research we've been looking at future travel in different areas. And I don't think the rest of the world realizes how far ahead implementation is in China in particular, but in Asia. And I think a lot of that is not because of regulation of AI as such. It's because of things like consumer protection in the European Union means that there's so much in Europe and the US to some degree, there's so much danger around travel services making recommendations to people because if they get them wrong, there's lots of comeback. In China, things have accelerated, not because the model is necessarily better, but because there's fewer barriers to those, fewer costs to things going wrong quite in that sense. So it does sound like it's quite futuristic compared to other parts of the world.
Yeah, I think in terms of that, there are two maybe differences between people in China and people in other countries. First of like cybersecurity related to the specialty of reach. In the past, we have like unofficial saying that Chinese people don't care about privacy. It's not that like that we don't care about privacy. It's a lot more like people are willing to exchange the privacy for convenience, for additional benefits the technology can provide to them. So in terms of AI, we are like so easy, so ready to accept, embrace AI into our life, even though we know that all the platforms are like monitoring, all the platforms have all kinds of consumption of our personal information, but we are like willing to embrace the benefits of technology bring us rather than like, okay, we have a hard line that you cannot use our information. I think that's perhaps one of the driving forces why such things are so developed in China.
Can I just say, I was a little bit surprised that survey revealed only a third of British travelers. I found that quite low, actually. I was quite happy to see the segmentation there between the different profiles, because as you know, our colleagues here have illustrated to us, the benefits are numerous. I mean, I use AI every day, you know. Mm. It's not because I can't do anything for myself, it's because it offers me so many potential extra opportunities, you know, where it challenges me in different ways. And, you know, to lead into some of the topics here, tourism, for example, sports tourism is a massive growth area, you know, not just here in Europe, but also in Asia and America as well. And so the ability of sports fans, you know, to identify opportunities, places to go safely, et cetera, all the topics we've been talking about, AI is a massive support tool there. As well, which is only, you know, getting smarter and smarter, better and better. It's not going to replace everything. It's just an extension maybe of what you're doing. I use it on a daily basis also to help me prepare my lessons, you know, for teaching bachelor students and master students. I actually give AI my exam papers and ask AI to fill it in based on the content I've taught the students in the lesson to see whether AI can actually come up with the right answers. And if AI can do it, you know, then basically I know my students should be able to do it as well. So I think it's a wonderful initiative, and I hope it continues to develop, you know, safely for everybody in the future. But it's it has already changed our lives in many, many different ways. So I think it's a fantastic tool. And I'm going to check out, Google Gemini as well to see if I can get some new learnings there as well. Thanks for the tip.
Liz, you're welcome.
Thanks.
I mean, the cybersecurity guy is saying it's the secure one, so.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with that at the moment.
Yeah.
The ones that I worry about a little bit sometimes.
But what's the phrase? We don't do product endorsements, but Google's the only one that's actually a label session with clients, so it's fine. So it's like, probably best. But I also think something really interesting. You mentioned sports tourism as an example. I think there's some of the, some elements of travel where kind of digital travel is actually quite a pain point. that AI can come forward quite quickly. And one of the ones that, for instance, I think it was, is a classic example of that is rebooking, partly because what's happened through the transition into digital travel is everyone books everything independently. And what then happens is you then have a flight that runs late. Sport tourism is a classic example where you know that there's an event your whole group's trying to get to, and there's a hotel somewhere that you booked, and there's maybe a connecting journey of some kind. And actually, at the moment, digital travel is really painful around that because, for instance, you're flying to one destination, and you've got a minibus that's booked, and then you're going to get to the stadium at a certain time, and you've got to go to a restaurant beforehand. Actually, at the current moment, digital travel is really painful on that because someone's going to be realizing that the flight's gone late and then trying to ring someone in a different language, and then it's all kind of very stressful. That's a classic example where you can see AI agents coming through quite quickly. You might be able to rebook across different things or suggest things you can do as a group differently. There are some really interesting, I guess, big problems that are currently not the classic glamorous ones in the sense of they're not necessarily creating a new booking.com with AI, but there's some really big opportunities to solve problems using the tech a different way.
What are your guys' thoughts on the article also mentions that like it's as low as 15% of those people then said that they would admit that they used AI. And then I thought it was quite funny that some it said even lower, that 8% would admit after a few drinks.
I think that's a reflection of British culture. we're not very good at admitting, you know, when we need help from other.
F1 is growing its audience and growing a large female fan base for the first time. And Lululemon has just signed F1 driver Lewis Hamilton as an ambassador. Which seems like a big step forward for this plan. How much can sponsors and partners be the driver of innovation for a sport rather than simply providing dollars? Richard, this seems like a perfect question for you.
Yeah, I thought you'd come to me there first. Yeah, I've been working in the Formula One world on a couple of occasions in the 90s with Williams and Red Bull Racing. On the sponsor side about 10 years ago or so. Yeah, it's an unbelievable marketing platform and only, I think, getting more powerful since Liberty Global Media took over a few years ago. Before that, it was definitely run in a slightly different way. And of course, you know, Drive to Survive and Netflix has opened up Formula One to a completely new audience and largely credited with a female growing. So it doesn't surprise me that more female-orientated brands are entering, and this one with Lewis Hamilton and Lululemon is a classic example. To answer your question, whether they can start to really drive change through a sport like Formula One, I think a lot of it depends on the type of association, and perhaps if there's one megastar in Formula One, it's Lewis Hamilton, with no disrespect, you know, to all the other highly talented drivers in the sport, but Lewis is really, you know, the king in this respect. And so maybe his potential impact, you know, might be more valuable in the future. But having said that, you also have to remember that he's had a 6-year relationship with Tommy Hilfiger before that. You know, Tommy Hilfiger is a completely different brand. He's also associated with financial services groups. He's associated with helmets in racing, Monster Energy, for example. He's also associated with some, retail brands in the vegan space, Neat Burger and Bramble and things like that. So he's got a lot of brands on his uniform and a lot of hats to wear there. So Lululemon will have to come up with some great creative and concepts in order to cut through, in order to get that message across. And also they'll have to really show, you know, that they're adding value for a female audience. So it's like a lot of things, you know, you've got to encourage an audience to trust you first, you know, and that it's not just sport washing or greenwashing or something similar. But I think with Lewis's reputation, if they use it in the right way, there's definitely the potential there for them to maybe do some things that other brands haven't been able to do in that space before. But it's just like Formula One itself. It's a really competitive environment, and you've got to have a very good operation in there to make sure that it all comes to fruition.
Yeah, I think I echo what Richard said. It's really up to how Lululemon is going to develop creative and new concepts in this process. I know, for example, another like a similar case, like esports. Esports used to be perceived as a very male like center kind of sport game, but now these days, in among the younger generations, also actually there are quite a lot of female young generations that also play esports. So the esports actually it became like not like a male like centered activity. So similar for F1, I think. Even though I believe that I don't know the number exactly, but I think female fans, they are also the space, the proportion is also becoming bigger over time. And the reason why become fan, not only I think it's also becoming more diverse, not only just like cheerleader of the champion, but also I know there are a lot of some like female like mechanics and people working in the backwards of F1. I think this is all the inspirations Lululemon can take for how to make the brand actually relevant with F1 and sometimes with the female audiences. Another perspective I'm thinking perhaps a little bit creative, I think is about masculinity. So the F1 is a very masculine brand, of course. But the global, I think, masculinity, the concept is also changing. Of course, different in different countries, different cultures, but also I think mental wellness is being, I think, increasingly be aware and being being publicly admitted. And not only about female, but also men also have like a mental, I don't know, problem. Perhaps problem is not a precise word, like issues relating to the mental. Lululemon is like a holistic concept of wellness, and the mental and emotions all part of like a very, very central value the brand offer. I think if the Lululemon can also play a little bit on the masculinity, so I think there's also like innovating, there could play create a lot of innovative concepts which related to this masculine brand like F1. That's my to our thoughts at this moment.
If I can add into that, I think it's maybe a brave decision for Lululemon to go into Formula One, considering it has been perceived as a male domain for many years, because, you know, you have things like the Women's European Football Championships this year, you know, and women's soccer, women's football is also a massive upward curve. And so maybe, you know, if you want to target, you know, not just women, but also men as well, you could potentially reach it through a soccer audience, you know, which is also diverse and broad, and combined with the fact that Lewis has just joined a new Formula One team in Ferrari this year, you know, and that also has a certain identity that you have to accommodate if you want a partner. Depends, of course, what type of relationship they've agreed with him, whether it's on track and whether he's allowed to use that identity, or whether it's going to be completely off track and only in Lululemon clothes. I was personally introduced to Lululemon a number of years ago by one of our children. And I actually own some of their clothing. I can attest that it's actually very comfortable, just as Lewis said in the press release. And I think it's a wonderful brand, you know, for what it offers in terms of the sort of athleisure leisure market, as it's often referred to. So I think it's a brave move, but it's going to be an interesting move to see whether, you know, they can really, connect with a different audience, you know, through Formula One, and at the moment in sport, it's completely crazy. You know, anything is possible in the professional sports world. I mean, Ryan Reynolds buying Wrexham. You know, there's billionaires moving into all sorts. Pickleball is getting hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, there's things happening today in sport you couldn't script, you know, 10 years ago. So yeah, you know, if Lululemon have got a clear strategy and they execute accordingly, why not? You know, why would it not be a great success for them and also for the customers that they're trying to service?
That's actually, that helped me to think about how, so if a brand wants to kind of expand, I think creating contribution that advances the sport, for example, not just for financial gain, which is good, but to help advance the sport. For example, when Kim Kardashian, controversial, teamed up with the NBA, that was to help advance the NBA, but also for brand. So with Lululemon and F1, I think with their expertise in fabric and heat dissipation and all that, that can help advance the sport as well. You know? not just their partnership.
It's interesting as well how combined the kind of fashion and sport world is now. You know, it's interesting, the NFL has a fashion director now. It's the first sports, you know, governing body in the world to have a fashion director. Like, these are very much intertwined spaces. In some ways, I think, because music's become less important than culture. So actually sport becomes even more important as the kind of platform on which you can, you know, show new ways, you know, both the sort of like one of the few things that has that mass attention that everybody across the whole community is getting interested in. And then Phoebe, to your point, in terms of masculinity and things, kind of lots of these kind of conversations were kind of wrapped up in music culture before, whereas now that's much less, fewer stars coming through there. Really, sport in a way is filling that gap, I think, in culture to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, it's sport is a very multifaceted space, and you know, we could talk about, you know, Colin Kaepernick and Nike and what happened there. You know, there's a whole host of examples. You know, you can look on the social side with a brand like Patagonia, for example, you know, and how they've maybe changed people's perceptions of what they should be wearing, what they should be buying, you know, how we recycle clothes. So I think you've got to have a narrative. You know, you've got to have a clear message. And perhaps it goes back to the early point that Phoebe was making, also about your values, you know, your philosophy. You know, if you're not authentic and it hasn't been embedded, you know, into your roots, then certainly Gen Z and the younger consumers will sense that immediately, and it's a turnoff. You know, so there's got to be something in there which is genuine. It's got to be based around, you know, it's got to fit with Lewis's beliefs. You know, if there's a disconnect with Lewis, it ain't going to work. You know, the days of, you know, just wearing a piece of clothing or slapping a logo on it are long gone, thankfully. You know, so there's got to be a very synergistic relationship there. You know, it's a bit like, you know, Dove and real people. You know, again, these campaigns, you know, when they come out, they look so natural, as if, you know, why didn't we think of that before? You know, and you can tell as soon as a campaign has really been properly developed, properly researched, understands the audience, you know, that they're trying to engage with. And so, yeah, maybe in 6 months' time, you know, we'll be able to look back and see whether Lululemon has hit the nail on the head, or, you know, whether they're still on their way.
The one thing, Richard, I think is an interesting thing for the sports sector just now is that, you know, as an industry, like you're saying, incredible levels of innovation happening in sport all around the world, different sports, different areas. A lot of that is being driven by, it's interesting, the role of players changing, perhaps, in terms of media personalities and sponsors coming in. The one thing I would say, maybe as a watch out, maybe for the sector, is, you know, a lot of these brands coming in, we know them well, very interesting organizations, but in 5 years' time, when the deal's up, they'll be looking for where the best deal is. It's interesting in terms of how the sports themselves can start to actually embed something or build something long term, given so much is driven by external factors currently.
Yeah, I mean, you're jumping ahead a little bit to my sort of one of the points I wanted to contribute towards the end, which is, you know, the sports industry doesn't have a problem in generating revenue. The sports industry has a problem in actually expenses, in how it spends its revenue, you know, which then pushes, you know, teams and leagues and competitions, you know, to constantly look for more money and more investment. Formula One has actually made an effort, you know, to try to put a cap on some of the spending limits, you know, so that the so-called smaller teams have a chance of competing with the bigger teams. So I think it speaks to a wider trend in society about governance and regulation, you know, and responsibility and ethical leadership and things like that. Is, you know, we have to try and make sure that in my sector, sport and entertainment, you know, that it's not just a financial arms race where, you know, it's just more money and more money and more money, and only the biggest, you know, can win and only the biggest can survive. So I think in some respects, you're absolutely right. Is, yes, in 5 years' time, that Formula One team or Lewis Hamilton, if he's still driving, will be looking for that, you know, next best deal. And that's the nature of the industry, that they need that in order to survive. But maybe we can find a more financially sustainable way of managing sport and entertainment and brands. Thankfully, big brands like Unilever and Lululemon, Lululemon's a $5 billion company, they can put pressure on the leaders in these industries in order to take more, you know, sensible decisions. You know, and all the things we've spoken about today, whether it's, you know, IT and security and artificial intelligence, etc., can hopefully have a positive role in helping these organizations to be more financially sustainable in the future. And not to forget, you know, the fan or the customer at the end of the day, because everybody keeps saying, you know, we're all customer centric, we're all fan centric. Well, let's show it. You know, let's make sure that these fans who buy Lululemon products and all the others actually get the benefits that they deserve, you know, through Lewis or through whatever association that might be. That would be my dream for the future, you know, is that the sports industry actually gets more grip, more control on the way in which it, you know, can create value and not just, you know, take the highest dollar, so to speak, you know, from whoever might be offering it at that particular point in time.
To wrap up, we like to ask all of our guests what their cultural pick of the week is. So this is the best music, film, TV, design, book, something that's inspired you this week and that you'd like to share with us.
I'm always, you know, following the sports industry. That's my passion. I'm going to go back a little bit to some of the things that we're you know, been talking about before, but I think we're used to, you know, a lot of money pouring into big sports. But I think it's a positive trend for me is, you know, is now some of the investment is also going into the so-called smaller sports. And recently last week, there was an announcement of $100 million, you know, investment into Women's Volleyball League, you know, which is a phenomenal amount of money. It's for a league in America, which is known as LOVB, but it's pronounced Love, from a venture capital firm called Atwater Capital, you know. And it's just it's great to see more investment going into the women's game. It's you know, been underfunded for years, and normally it tends to migrate towards the big sports, the American footballs and the basketballs of this world and stuff. So you know, this particular deal includes a broadcast deal with ESPN, for example, supporting over 58 youth clubs in volleyball. So it's going all the way down to the grassroots of the sport. And that's something which I think is, you know, it's supported by celebrities again, Jason Derulo, for example, and people like that. So it just confirms to me that, you know, sport has the ability to touch, you know, all parts of society. And it's not just about the rich and the famous, you know, and the Super Bowls of this world. I love to see it, you know, when, you know, other people benefit as well from investment and create value further down the food chain, so to speak. So that's the sort of story which I'm always happy to see, despite the fact, you know, that we all watch the sort of the superstar events. It's good to see the grassroots and other sports evolving as well.
So, it's actually a TV show, and it's called Shrinking. It's on Apple TV. Mm-hmm. A great show. So it's a comedy about therapists. It's actually a great show. Harrison Ford is actually really funny, which I didn't know. He's like the head therapist at his practice, and you just see how therapists, they have a lot of knowledge and training about how to fix us, I guess you could say, but they're all so broken. And it just reminds me that no matter the field or the experience, we'll never know everything. And we're always trying to learn the most we can in our field. So it's almost like confronting imposter syndrome. Like, I don't know everything. And so what? Nobody does. My boss here, I'm sure I could ask him a question and he'd be like, I don't know. He might dance around it a bit, but I'm sure there's some things that he doesn't know. So being comfortable with not knowing everything and continuing to learn our fields.
So I have a hat on. I'm involved with an art gallery, which is in Edinburgh. So it's very niche for this podcast because not everyone can come to Edinburgh. But if you can, top of Calton Hill, beautiful view. And the new show is the Gerwood Survey. So it's lots of the most interesting artists in the UK, young artists in the or emerging artists in the UK.
It was Oscars night last night. And in the grand scheme of things, it was very tame. No slaps, no wrong big picture, no wrong best picture announcements. But they did pick a really great best picture. And I think it's the first time for as long as I can remember where I actually agree with what they picked. And it's a film called Anora, by a really great filmmaker called Sean Baker, who did like The Florida Project and Red Rocket and just fantastic film. So it's not in cinemas anymore, but it'll probably be on stream at some point.
Pretty controversial up into the Oscars and then very tame Oscars itself. So, you know.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you everyone for joining us. And we hope that you're all caught up in the world of innovation this week. If you want to get access to label sessions for your brand or have your teams mentored by our leaders, get in touch via our website or any of the social networks around. See you next week.